I am State Representative Valerie Gatos. Welcome to my podcast. Today I have on Andy Masick, who is the president and CEO of the Senator John Hines History Center.
It's great being here with you because I know that you're a history lover, too. And we've got more than our fair share of history here in Western Pennsylvania.
There's no doubt about that. Well, first tell us a little bit about the History Center and tell me what the mission of the History Center is and how the History Center is fulfilling that mission in our community.
The Hines History Center is Pennsylvania's largest history museum. I mean, it's 350,000 square feet in the old Chautauqua Lake Ice Company warehouse right next to the convention center in Pittsburgh's Strip District. Today, we tell the stories of people. We're the people museum. You know, I know that there's a zoo and there are art museums and there are other types of museums, dinosaurs, but we're the museum that tell the stories of people, people who have made a difference and changed the world and inspire future generations. And that's what our mission is to tell history in a way that people can use it to make good decisions in the present and plans for the future.
Well, you certainly achieved that goal. The USA Today just cited the Hines History Center as the best history center in the nation. How did they come across that?
Yeah, USA Today has 4.6 million readers, and they send their editors out around the country, and they came up with a short list of great museums. Two of them were Smithsonian museums. The National World War II Museum in New Orleans was on the list. We were in that top 10. Then they had their 4.6 million readers vote on who they thought was the best museum, and we came out on top. The Hines History Center is America's best history museum.
That's really awesome because that's a whole list of other museums that are pretty impressive as well. So that's cool to be on that list.
It's pretty good company. You're right about it. And we get about 375,000 people a year come from all over the world to the History Center in Pittsburgh.
Where is the largest number of attendees coming from?
You know, about 68% of our visitors come from beyond the seven-county region. And that wasn't always that way. 15 years ago, I'd say 70% of the people came from Allegheny County. But now we have a national reputation, and so people are coming from all over the world, all over the United States. And about 40% or so are from our 10-county area.
You know, what's fascinating about that and that what people really need to recognize is that Pittsburgh is and was the gateway to the West and really built America with all of the Industrial Revolution. Yeah. It really was something that was significant in our history that built America. So it is kind of neat to see that the Hines History Center is getting the attention that it deserves.
You're absolutely right. And Pittsburgh was the gateway to the West. When Meriwether Lewis came here in 1803 with his Corps of Discovery, he knew he was starting that exploration at the starting point, the three rivers that came together here, the Monongahela and Allegheny forming the Ohio. That was the highway that would take people to the West. And Thomas Jefferson, the president then in 1803, he didn't really know what was out there. He had Meriwether Lewis studying Hebrew because he thought the lost tribes of Israel might be out there someplace in the Wild West. He had Lewis studying flora and fauna because they thought they might find mastodons or woolly mammoths out there in the West. That's how little they knew of the West. And so Meriwether Lewis builds his keelboat, a 55-foot keelboat, at Fort Fayette, which is where the convention center is today, named, of course, for Lafayette. And they shoved off in August of 1803. They went 2.5 miles to the first island on the Ohio River, Bruno's Island.
Bruno Island, yeah. Right.
Dr. Bruno came with Lafayette in 1778 to help the Americans fight their revolution. And then he started a farm on that little island. Well, Lewis shoves off his keelboat, and they make it to the island. This is the maiden voyage. They've just caught the seams on this thing. They don't know if it's going to sink or not. And so he unloads his men. The mayor and about 15 dignitaries are waiting for them on Bruno's Island, and they all want to see what their tax dollars had purchased, because this was the most...
We all want to know what our tax dollars are being spent on.
Absolutely.
Sure.
Nothing's changed. And so Lewis had chronometers and sextants, and he had an air rifle, a rifle that could fire 20 rounds without reloading, just by cocking the hammer. And so everyone wanted to see this thing shoot. So Lewis said, okay, I'll show you. Lewis was an expert marksman. He was part of the chosen rifle company that William Clark had captained during the Whiskey Rebellion in the 1790s.
Right, Whiskey Rebellion, that's another thing that's right here in western Pennsylvania, Whiskey Rebellion.
Absolutely. And so Lewis puts a mark on a tree about 50 paces away. He fires seven times. He hits the mark dead center each time. Everybody's amazed. A guy in the audience named Blaise Sanus goes up to Lewis and grabs the rifle out of his hands. That's amazing. Let me try it. It goes off. It hits a woman in the head. Feathers go flying from her hat. She drops like a shot mallard. Lewis is beside himself the first day of the journey, and he's already shot the mayor's wife.
Oh, dear.
It wasn't really the mayor's wife. It was Dr. Bruneau's niece, Betsy Bruneau, and the ball scored her skull, left an ugly gash, but didn't kill her. Lewis got her back on her feet. She was wobbly, but she was alive, and he said, boys, get back on the boat. Let's get out of here. They shove off. They go 500 yards, and they get stuck on a sandbar.
And where's that sandbar?
That sandbar is just upstream from McKee's Rocks. And they have to unload 10 tons of supplies and with ropes drag the boat over the sandbar, get it floated again.
So, Andy, how many people were typically on the boat? What was the size of the crew?
Well, early in the mission, there were only about 18 men. He recruited some of them from Pittsburgh. He acquired his dog, too, that big Newfoundland dog.
So 18 men took this boat across a sandbar.
They had to unload it, put the goods onto shallow draft pirogues and canoes, and refloat the boat, drag it over that sandbar. And, well, the bad news is this happened three times before they got to McKee's Rocks.
Oh,
and if you read the journals of Lewis and Clark, they're famous. You could go to any Barnes & Noble or any library. Just read page one.
But
and
here's
it'll tell the story of leaving Pittsburgh, getting stuck. He said, I gave them each a dram of whiskey and put them to bed exhausted.
But Andy, we can read all about this. But your enthusiasm and your storytelling as part of the History Center is really what brings this alive. And that's why people should be going to the History Center to hear all this, to just, you know, get that emotion that of what really happened in our local history.
Well, you know, you had mentioned earlier that this was the gateway to the West. Before Europeans arrived, this was a convening place for the native peoples of the Three Rivers. In fact, they called this place Allegheny. That was the Seneca name for this convergence of rivers that was kind of a safe place, a neutral place where different tribes could come together and not fight. There were Delawares and Shawnees and Senecas.
And now the History Center has a new exhibit, right?
At the Fort Pitt Museum, which is a branch museum of the Hines History Center, located right at the confluence at Point State Park, a new exhibit called Native Nations of Allegheny. And it's all about those first peoples. I mean, I think people have heard of Gaiasuta, a Seneca man who greeted young George Washington, 21-year-old George Washington, red-haired, 6 feet, 2.5 inch tall George Washington, who comes out here all alone in 1753 to confront the French, who are building forts down the Allegheny River. And Washington records in his journal, geez, somebody needs to build a fort at this point, because whoever does controls the western waters. And in those days, the rivers were the highways. You couldn't get through these dense forests, so people traveled by water.
Now, when you were talking, you and I were talking earlier, we were talking about just the history of boat building in Pittsburgh because of our waters. And you listed a statistic saying that how many miles that somebody can walk on a boat. Tell me a little bit about, you know, that history of boat building in Pittsburgh, in the Pittsburgh area. And right here, actually, in the 44th District, where we have the Shousetown Boatyard.
Absolutely. And your district was the Shousetown Boatyard. Nearly 100 boats.
And where is that specifically located, so people can understand where that is?
You know, I can't tell you exactly where that marker is located.
And that's the thing. Some of these markers are kind of hidden, which we've got to make sure that people know where these markers are. So we'll definitely get a list, and we'll post a list of those markers for everybody.
The Pennsylvania Historical and Museum Commission, the PHMC, as we affectionately call it.
Of which you are on that commission.
I'm a commissioner, and it is a state agency. It's the official agency for history in Pennsylvania. And there are 2,500 of these markers all over the state. The Shousetown marker near Route 51 tells the story of those boats that were laid down here. And then probably the engines would have been built in Pittsburgh proper. You know, these are iron steam engines. And the place that you mentioned, people could walk a mile on boats without even touching water, would have been the Monongahela Wharf. We hear about that wharf today when there's high water and people have to move their cars so they don't get flooded. But 150 years ago, boats were parked side by side, touching for a mile up the Monongahela River. You could actually jump from boat to boat for a mile without touching water. That's how many boats there were.
Yeah, that's definitely remarkable, but it shows the boat building history in our region. A couple other markers that are in the 44th District. I mentioned D.T. Watson Home. That was certainly where Jonas Salk did a lot of his studies for the polio vaccine and were instrumental. And that's one of those markers as well that's right up on Camp Meeting Road.
Well, think about that for a minute. 50, 75, 100 years ago, millions of people around the world, especially children, were afflicted with polio, a debilitating disease that left them paralyzed or dead. They couldn't breathe. And so Jonas Salk, a scientist and physician here in Pittsburgh, comes up with this idea of using a killed virus, real polio virus, but kill it and then inject it into the patient, and the patient builds antibodies that will fight that deadly virus. Well, they had to test it on someone, and first kids, disabled kids at the Watson.
There were a lot of people that volunteered to give themselves to this study, and it was incredibly remarkable.
It was frightening. And then kids at local schools, at Arsenal Middle School, at 40th Street and Butler were the next test group. And then finally schools. But I have to tell you that Salk tested it on himself first and then his own children. So that's how confident that he was. 1955. It's determined to be safe and effective. Everybody gets those vaccines. Many people still bear the marks on their arms of those early polio vaccines, but it changed the world.
It did. And you know what's really interesting about this is that my dad, Ed Gatiss, was in dental school, and he collected spit samples for Jonas Salk. And he said he remembered going into the lab, watching him, and, you know, wasn't sure what he was really up to. But of course, those couple years after that, you know, when we developed the vaccine. And then my other uncle, John Gatiss,
he actually was one of the early doctors that was up there at D.T. Watson helping try to help this discovery solve a big world problem. But what this really points to is the amount of innovation that is here in Pittsburgh and certainly memorialized at the Heinz History Center.
You're absolutely right. This is a place, a special place for invention and innovation. And at the History Center, we have a whole exhibit called Pittsburgh, a tradition of innovation. Everything from the polio vaccine to the Jeep. And how did that happen? You know, I think part of it is that this region was isolated for so long. Imagine those Allegheny Mountains that George Washington had to get past. And it took 6 weeks to get to Philadelphia in those days, crossing over mountains, double teaming your horses and wagons to get them over those steep passes. And so the people here had to make do. They had to figure things out on their own, and they developed their own culture, their own language, a sense of independence. And you mentioned earlier the Whiskey Rebellion. That independence can sometimes get the best of them, because those Scots-Irish farmers who were out here when Alexander Hamilton and George Washington imposed that first excise tax on whiskey, well, these farmers were converting their rye and their wheat into whiskey, something that could be stored and was fungible, could be taken to market. And when the government said, well, we're going to tax it big because we don't want a lot of small producers. We're going to give the big producers a break. And we're really going to run the little guys out of business.
Well, plus they were using the liquor as a currency.
Absolutely.
In exchanging. And so, of course, you know, leave it up to the government to try to figure out how to tax. But I think, you know, that is what we, you know, as government, I think people don't mind being taxed. They just want to know what that tax is being used for. So, you know, knowing a little more about our history is really important. And I want to turn back to the Pennsylvania Historic and Museum Commission and the role of the PHMC, which you're on. Tell us a little bit about, you talked about the 2,500 markers that are throughout the state. Tell me what the role of the PHMC is. And of course, we in the State House, we're responsible for providing the funding to make sure that our students understand the history of Pennsylvania.
We are very fortunate to have one of the best state museums and historical organizations in the country. We just finished building a new state archives building. It just opened a month or so ago. And you can go online and do genealogical research or historical research, find out about your home or your community. And much of that is digitized. So you can go online
that
information.
You don't have to go to Harrisburg. So people don't have to go to Harrisburg.
Right.
That's great.
And the State Museum is in Harrisburg, but there are also branch museums that talk about things like lumber and oil.
Everything that built Pennsylvania.
And then the PHMC has this 2,500 marker program that is in every one of the 67 counties of Pennsylvania. And they also are a conduit for some state funding that goes to about 300 other museums that aren't operated by the state but do good work, like the Heinz History Center.
Well, tell us about some of the upcoming events that are happening here with the Heinz History Center.
We just opened an exhibit called A Woman's Place, How Women Shaped Pittsburgh. And we have 100 women who have terrific stories that will amaze you. I mean, they're Supreme Court justices, they're doctors, they're lawyers, they're teachers, they're sports stars, soldiers.
Which we just started a women's soccer team that is now Rosie the Riveter.
Riveters. Do you know the story of Rosie the Riveter?
I do know, but you know what? Tell us a little bit about that. Plus, also, you and I talked about a friend of mine who was related to the gentleman who worked for Westinghouse who created the image of what we consider Rosie the Riveter.
J. Howard Miller was a Westinghouse artist. He was a contract artist, and he got a contract to do 40 posters during World War II to kind of spur on the war effort. 50,000 women took the place of men in the mills and factories. And these women had to learn a new job. They had to get to work. And in late 1942, Miller comes up with this poster of a Westinghouse woman war worker making a muscle and with a balloon over her head saying, "We can do it." Well, Miller had seen Westinghouse employees rolling up their sleeves saying, let's show them what we can do. And he riffed on that, came up with the "We Can Do It" poster. The very week that poster came out in February of 1943, a popular song hit the radio.
Which
you
was?
Ready for this? "All the day long, whether rain or shine, she's a part of the assembly line. She's making history, working for victory, Rosie the Riveter."
Nice. Well,
the people of America heard that song, saw the poster, and said, "You know what? That's Rosie the Riveter." He didn't call her Rosie. It was serendipitous that the song and the poster came out.
I didn't know that. Yeah. Oh, that's, well, see, those are the kind of things of we need to learn at the Heinz History Center. Tell me a little bit about how the History Center got founded and why is it named after U.S. Senator Heinz, who was our senator in here in Pennsylvania?
I'm glad you asked, because the Heinz History Center is actually Pittsburgh's oldest cultural institution. It started in 1879 as the Historical Society of Western Pennsylvania. But after Senator Heinz was tragically killed in an airplane crash in the 1980s, it was thought we needed to honor him in some way. And the History Center was moving from Oakland, from its original location, to the Strip District in the old Chautauqua Lake Ice Company warehouse, a seven-story building right next to the convention center. And so Senator John Heinz is for whom we're named, but that's the same Heinz family as the ketchup family. And so a lot of people associate the History Center with ketchup, which is a great story. I have to tell you, when Ed Sheeran visited us recently, Ed Sheeran, the performer, the singer.
Musician. Yep.
He loves ketchup. And he has tattooed on his right bicep a Heinz ketchup bottle.
Oh, that's amazing.
So he wanted to see the ketchup museum. And so we said, you know, we're not just ketchup. We're all about Western Pennsylvania history. But we do have a ketchup exhibit. And so he came in. He did a self-tour with his iPhone. Right after that, we had 250,000 hits on our website after Ed Sheeran came. But the thing he loved when he went away was his own pickle pin. The pickle pin, I brought one for you.
Oh, thank you very much.
This is a gold one.
Gold pickle pin.
They only made those for 1 year. 1869 was the first year of Heinz. And for the 150th anniversary, they produced gold pickle pins. But the original pickle pins were made in 1893. The little green ones,
yes,
that every Western
Pennsylvanian
has.
Oh, I've had
in
dozens.
Their jewelry box.
Well, I had worked for U.S. Senator Heinz when I was in college, and his whole passion for history of this region, and also being involved in the Pittsburgh Heritage Trust, Cultural Trust, excuse me, the Cultural Trust was instrumental in not just history, but also arts and culture, everything that we do here in Pittsburgh.
Well, you know, it was his grandfather, great-grandfather, who really branded the Heinz business. They first started making pickles.
Sauerkraut. I think it was sauerkraut, wasn't it?
Well, horseradish.
Horseradish.
And so in 1893, he went to the World's Fair in Chicago, and they put him up on the second floor of the exhibit hall. And nobody was taking the 100 steps required, because this is before elevators or escalators. So on the fly, Heinz printed up these little luggage tags. They had brass foil on it, so it kind of looked like gold. And he hired little boys to throw them around on the first floor of the exhibit hall. And men and women walking arm in arm would catch the glint of gold out of the corner of their eye. They'd pick up the tag. It said, "Bring to the Heinz booth on the second floor for a free prize." "Well, honey, let's go see what we want." And they trooped up the stairs by the thousands, by the hundreds of thousands.
And they gave them ketchup?
They didn't give them ketchup. They gave them the pickle pin. And that's why.
That's the history of the pickle pin.
Yeah. It was really a gimmick to get people to take the stairs. And the New York Times learned about this. They did a story about Heinz and they said, a young entrepreneur who found himself in a pickle was saved by one. And that's how the marketing genius and the legend of H.J. Heinz began.
So you have a huge H.J. Heinz ketchup, Heinz ketchup exhibit. Tell us what's in that exhibit.
Well, in the exhibit, you can learn about his mom who had a garden and she taught him how to can things. He put those things in a wheelbarrow, took them downtown, sold them on the street. But by the turn of the century, he was the largest purveyor of food on the planet. He had salesmen on every continent except Antarctica. And he was all about pure food. The 1906 Pure Food and Drug Act.
That's right. That was huge. That's, you know, government's role in helping us have safer food. All that sort of stuff was really prompting.
He pushed that through. And he said that the key to success was to do a common thing uncommonly well. And that's what he did. He didn't invent ketchup. The Chinese had been making it for 1,000 years, but he did it better than anybody. And he used tomatoes in his ketchup that went from farm to factory in 24 hours.
Farm to factory in 24 hours? Yeah. Now, do we know where most of the farms were that he drew the...
Initially, they were all around Pittsburgh. I mean, every farmer probably had a garden that was feeding into the Heinz plant. But after, in later years, throughout the Midwest and then around the world.
Well, in North Fayette, we have Hankey Farms, the original farmhouse that was there that supplied a lot of Pittsburgh
right.
with all sorts of agriculture, whether it was wheat or just, you know, simply produce of all kinds. But it's really fascinating what the Heinz History Center has done to really memorialize everything that we are about Pittsburgh. And we talked about before a little bit about innovation. Tell us all the stuff that, you know, you celebrate in the Heinz History Center about innovation.
Well, as an affiliate of the Smithsonian Institution, we get to choose from 144 million objects and specimens that the Smithsonian has in its collection. So we populate our exhibits with Smithsonian objects, such as the Jeep. The first Jeep in the history of the world was made here in Western Pennsylvania in 1940 on the eve of World War II. The government had sent out an RFP to 125 car makers in America. And think about that for a minute. There were 125 car makers in America in 1940. And they said, we need a vehicle that will replace the horse on the battlefield. Has to go any place a horse can go, has to be able to pull a gun, has to climb a 30-degree grade. And it can't weigh any more than a large horse. And you have to build a prototype in 49 days. Well, 49 days, all the big companies, Ford, GM, Willis Overland of Toledo, Ohio, they said, well, we can design this miracle car, but nobody can do it in 49 days. Well, this little outfit in Butler, Pennsylvania, the American Bantam Car Company, said, boys, nobody's buying our midget cars. Why don't we give it a shot? And they stayed up all night at a diner in Butler. And on a napkin, literally on a napkin, they sketched the design for the Jeep. And they built it in 48 days, 22 hours, delivered it. The government said, wow, this is just what we're talking about. We need 300,000 of them. When can you deliver? Well, these guys had never built more than 500 units of anything in a year's time in the history of their company. And now the government wanted all these hundreds of thousands. The Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor. America found itself in a shooting war. And the government had to pull the contract from Bantam and give it to Ford and to Willis Overland.
Does the Heinz History Center have a Jeep there, right there?
We have the oldest Jeep on planet Earth, on loan from the Smithsonian, and it's right there in our Great Hall. You can see it. People come from all over the world to to pay homage to this.
So all you Jeep lovers, we have it right here in Pittsburgh Heinz History Center. Wow. Well, tell me what are some of the upcoming exhibits you have, or what is really highlighted?
Right now we are featuring A Woman's Place. It's about 100 women who shaped Western Pennsylvania history. And, you know, they're doctors and lawyers and soldiers and athletes. But one that I think is a great story is Nellie Bly. Nellie Bly was born in 1864, not far from here. And she moved to Pittsburgh after her father died. Her mother brought the 10 kids.
She was bold.
Her. Oh, my goodness. And Nellie read an article in the Pittsburgh Gazette titled, "What Are Girls Good For?" Well, this set Nellie off. She wrote a rebuttal to this. The editor of the Pittsburgh Gazette was so impressed. It was so articulate, so well argued, that he hired her. And she becomes an investigative reporter.
Yeah.
She goes around the world in 72 days with one small piece of luggage and one change of clothes. And in 72 days, she makes it all the way around the world. People didn't think that could be done. Jules Verne, the science fiction writer, had written a book called Around the World in 80 Days, and people poo-pooed that and said, that's impossible.
So her whole background in travel, what do? We have her up at the Pittsburgh airport, have a statue to Nellie Bly, because we really want to make Pittsburgh the center of transportation.
Well, you'll notice at the airport, she's holding a little bag, a little grip, an alligator grip. We have that actual bag on exhibit at the History Center right now in our Woman's Place exhibit. And notice at the airport, next to her are George Washington and Franco Harris.
That's it.
Everybody wants their picture taken with Franco, and I understand that. He is an icon of our region, and not only a great athlete, but a great human being. But those three people were all 21 years old when they made history here in Pittsburgh.
But wasn't Nellie Bly also very instrumental in going undercover into mental institutions,
right,
really revealing what can be done to improve the care that we have for the mentally ill? And that was really remarkable because she didn't tell anybody. She just went in there and
she got herself arrested and thrown into this insane asylum in New York, which had a terrible reputation. And she was America's first investigative reporter. 10 days in an insane asylum, she blew the lid off of the poor care we gave to people with mental disorders.
And because of her, there were a lot of changes that were made. But that's really remarkable to have somebody just go in there and not even understanding whether they were going to be able to get out. And
it was nip and tuck there. She thought she was going to die in there. After that, talk about bold, she becomes a war correspondent during World War I. a woman war correspondent. After that, she becomes an industrialist and actually has patents for designing a new type of milk can. So she was the real deal.
Well, we're delighted to have the statue in the Pittsburgh airport celebrating Nellie Bly, because I think that it's a story that people really should delve into, because it gives you that courage to do a lot of things to make changes in our society. That's
right,
for sure.
Right.
And the History Center, to learn more about history. And Andy, with your wonderful storytelling, it really brings it alive. And I really encourage people to make sure they go to the Heinz History Center, not just once, not just twice, but make it a regular visit to go, because you have a lot of changing exhibits.
I hope so. And in October and November, kids are free at the History
Kids are
Center.
Free at the Heinz History Center,
thanks
October,
to
November.
UPMC Health Plan and UPMC, they've sponsored it. So any kid can come anytime. And it's free at the History Center in October. And
oh, fabulous. Well, Andy, thank you for being on and sharing these stories. And again, I would love to have you keep coming and hearing different stories about things that are all history in Pennsylvania, in Pittsburgh, that makes us stronger to know what our past is. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Valerie. Keep making history.
Thank you.